traitors. And in the eyes of the great masses of workers, Stalinism was the revolutionary movement. But Trotsky had educated us through his writings and his books and so forth to the fact that socialism in one country meant exactly that. Socialism in one country, dash, and no other. So that had a big effect on the minds of revolutionary workers. The terrible thing that happened in France, where the French workers, in collaboration with the small petty bourgeois party, had accomplished a big electoral victory, only to be told, "You don't know when the wind strikes, brother." This had a big effect on radical workers. Workers all the time express their thoughts and their ideas and so forth, but they can feel it. And a demoralization started to set in. Then to add everything to this came the famous Moscow trials, where Stalinism killed off the remnants of Lenin's party. All the revolutionary leaders and comrades of Lenin were wiped out and executed under the most horrible conditions possible. Well, these events had a big effect on the American working class, and you could sense that there was a wave of reaction starting in. From 1929 up to this time, there had been a wave of radicalism. But now, it was just the opposite. The big upheavals in the trade union movement came in 36 and 37, and by 1937 they were spent. It was only sporadic. The political movement was on the downgrade, the socialist and communist parties. And side by side with this came our troubles inside the Socialist Party. Under the wave of reaction came to the surface all the doubts and all the hesitations of these so-called militants. We said it with the trip into the Socialist Party, no question doubt about it, helped the American Trotskyist movement in the fight against the Moscow trials. We set up a Trotsky Defense Committee that had international connections. We rallied the cream of the liberals, the real liberals, not the phonies, the real liberals in this country, to a defense of Trotsky and Lenin's collaborators against world Stalinism. Now, when we went in, I forgot to mention that when we went in the Socialist Party, one of the precautions that was taken by these fakers, these so-called militants that took over the party, one of the precautions they took, that they figured they would pull our teeth out, was they forbid us to have our newspaper. We had no newspaper. Not only that, but they said you have to give up your magazine too. Now these were terrible blows. Didn't Lenin tell us that the newspaper is the national organizer of the party? That's why we have a newspaper. Not because we like it, not because we like to pay the deficit every week, going running into hundreds of dollars. No, we have it because we recognize that's the chief organizer of the party. It pulls it together and gives it a national stature. And it's the propaganda wing of the party. And we had to throw this into the waste pan, the waste bucket. It had been traditional in the socialist movement, the socialist party, that any state organization could have a paper of its own. But not when the Trotskyists entered. Oh, not you guys. So we had to discontinue the paper. We had to discontinue the magazine. Well, you can imagine if Hugo Ola was still in our party at that time. He said, didn't I tell you? Cannon's betraying you. Cannon's ready to sell out. Look at, he's ready to give up the paper. He's ready to give up the magazine. You guys are going to end up whooping it up for Norman Thomas and the Second International. No, we went into the Socialist Party. Cannon explained, we got a bigger job to do than just worrying about the militant. Don't worry, we'll find a way to talk. And we did. When we entered the Socialist Party, Albert Goldman, who had entered the Socialist Party a year ahead of us, started a little mimeograph paper in Chicago called the Socialist Appeal. And an understanding was reached with him before we entered the Socialist Party that he would put this little mimeograph paper at our service. And after a while, this little mimeograph paper suddenly became a four-page printed paper. And after a while, instead of a tabloid, it became a full-length regular newspaper. Well, now the leaders of this so-called militant gang were as follows. My notes are mixed up here. Did you comrades never heard of a guy named Gus Tyler? He was the chief altar boy for Dubinsky in the International Aid of Garment Workers Union. He became, shortly after we got thrown out of the Socialist Party, he became educational director of the International Aid of Garment Workers Union. This guy was a very excellent platform speaker, excellent. He could grasp all kinds of revolutionary ideas with a snap of the finger. And when we were in the Socialist Party, we used him as the chief battering ram in the name of Trotskyism to fight the Stalinists when we could get them onto the platform for a debate. And as Cannon says in his book, this young guy could quote Lenin backwards and forwards. The only trouble he had of being a revolutionary was he only lacked character, that's all. He came to a dance of ours after the war broke out. I was in New York at that time, 1939. And you know, we opposed the war right from the first shot. This guy's at a dance with the Trotskyists. And I knew him. So when he wanted to shake hands with me, I wouldn't shake hands with him. And he said, oh, I suppose you're one of these guys that's mad because I'm for the war. I said, that just didn't mean anything to him. Well, that was one of the great leaders of the militants. Then we had another guy named Porter. You comrades are too young. You weren't working during the Second World War. If you did, you'd curse this guy. He was on the War Labor Board. So he became a Democrat, Roosevelt guy. Then you heard of Andy Buehler, the great congressman from Wisconsin, Democratic Party congressman. He was another great leader of the socialists. Then there was another guy, Jack Altman, who was the brains, the organizational brains in the fight against us. He became the business agent, of national business agent of the, oh, I don't know, what do you call it, bookkeepers union or clerks or some damn thing like that. In other words, the whole gang of them ended up, after they had purged the Socialist Party of socialism, let's get rid of the Trotskyists, they all took trade union jobs, or they went over openly to the Democratic Party and became hacks for Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The leader of the unemployed movement, David Lasser, got a big job down in Washington. Joe Lash got a big job with Eleanor Roosevelt, I never forget what the hell it was, but in the governmental setup, the whole gang of them. And I think Lash has just scribbled a book about Eleanor Roosevelt. But these were the guys that, for some strange reason, as Cannon says, called themselves militants. He said he was never able to understand why they ever considered themselves leaders, much less being militant leaders. Now, under the work of the rank-and-file Trotskyists, the rank-and-file workers of the Socialist Party came over to the concept of the Fourth International and Trotskyism. And they looked to the Trotskyists, the left wing of the Socialist Party. By this time, we were known as the left wing. Not the left wing like the militants were, with a lot of no program, or if they did have a program, it was a half-baked program that said yes and no on both sides of every question. No, we threw, when we organized our caucus, called the Socialist Appeal Caucus, we organized it on a program calling for the Fourth International, not a new international, a Fourth International, calling on a program of uncompromising class struggle, calling on a program of no endorsing bourgeois politicians. When the convention came up of 1937, the Socialist Party National Committee met and made a new rule. You have to be in the party 4 years before you can be a delegate. See, they changed the rules as they went along when they realized that they represented nobody. We had the Socialist Party in our hip pocket. And if things were run fairly and squarely, we would have taken over the party at that convention, no doubt about it. Well, this was a notice to the Trotskyists that your days are numbered. Well, we raised holy heck over the different decisions they made in our paper, The Socialist Appeal. So they had another meeting of the National Committee which forbid any state organizations to have newspapers of their own. There was only one newspaper, that was the Socialist Appeal. That's what they meant. So the Socialist Appeal had to liquidate. It didn't liquidate because it wanted to. And we didn't liquidate it because we had our job done. There was still some more work to do. That is, there were still some militants laying around, militant workers laying around that we hadn't brought over 100% to us yet. So that now that they liquidated our paper on us, shut us off from being delegates to their convention, we had to operate through a new method of letter writing. That is, the political committee would send out a letter to different individuals in different localities, signed in the name of not the political committee, but the name of one comrade, because we weren't supposed to have an organization at all. And this would lay down the line on what to do and how to do. The final blow up came when LaGuardia, the famous mayor of New York City, a democratic demagogue, but an able man, ran for re-election of mayor of New York City, and Norman Thomas and the Socialist Party leadership endorsed him. Well, we had pushed through the convention, even though we had no delegates, we pushed through friends, a new law in the Socialist Party saying that the Socialist Party cannot endorse any bourgeois candidates. And hardly did the convention make that decision when Norman Thomas says, I endorse, what's his name, LaGuardia, Flower LaGuardia, whatever his name was. Didn't see, in other words, decisions in the Socialist Party weren't worth the paper they were written on. And the big wigs did as they goddamn well pleased, and they took all kinds of measures against left-wingers. That's always been the history of every reformist organization. You can lay it down as a law. Well, we raised the devil about this, and this was a real concrete issue, a principle. This was an issue that you could rally revolutionary workers against. They didn't want to go out and whoop it up for any capitalist candidate. And the result was that was the showdown. And when that came, they started to expel various comrades in New York City, and they picked on Massachusetts next. They did it just through the formality of having a statewide meeting and then telling you to scram, that's all. There's no debating. How could you debate with the multimillionaires, all kinds of screwy sky pilots, tin horn union bureaucrats on the make, chicken farmers in Massachusetts, a couple of them were chicken farmers, and so forth. What the hell? All they did was, we just tipped our hat and said goodbye, that's about it. But we didn't recognize these expulsions either, because well, we wanted to do a job in the Socialist Party, so we set up an organization called the Committee of the Expelled Branches. And we brought out the Socialist Appeal, of course, back into the old style, made it a full-size newspaper, and opened up a deadly campaign against the leadership of the Socialist Party that they didn't survive. Now we start taking the count, and what happened from this great tactical maneuver that was led by Comrade Cannon, under the advice of Comrade Trotsky, of course, because Cannon was in touch with Trotsky all the time. That's one thing about Cannon. Makes no secret of it, that before he did anything, he always contacted Trotsky. And as he said before, that he doesn't like an organization with one brilliant leader. Two leaders are better. Three leaders are better. Four leaders are better. But if there's only one, he'll do business with that man. And Trotsky was of the opinion, now you gotta get out. And it was under his guidance, carried out by Comrade Cannon, that we quit the Socialist Party and went into business for ourselves. Now we take an accounting. While we're in the Socialist Party, we made all kinds of, I might say in Boston at least, up until we went in the Socialist Party, we were isolated. We didn't know the first goddamn thing about mass work or you know, how to make connections and friends and so forth. We came out of the Socialist Party, we had a whole liberal periphery that we could talk to, that we met while we were in the Socialist Party. We met all kinds of trade union connections and so forth and so on. And this happened all over the country. While we were in the Socialist Party, we built our maritime fraction, starting out on the West Coast, where Cannon was on a very personal and friendly basis with Harry Lundberg, due to the fact that Lundberg was an old wobbly. And we started to penetrate the maritime industry, culminating in 1945 and 6, where we had 125, 130 comrades that were sailors in the maritime industry. We made terrific headway in the automobile union. We'd been wiped out when Olo quit the party, leaving us with not one single member in Detroit. We rebuilt a branch in Detroit, And we had Trumbridge and the various big plants that throughout the auto industry in Detroit, in Flint. Hermit Johnson came over to us, the man that founded the UAW in Local 699, I think it's called, Chevy Local in Flint, Michigan. We had connections in steel and so forth, up and down the line. And above everything else, the Trotskyist movement started to get proletarianized. That was one of the main things, main accomplishments. Because up to this time, the party was overwhelming, you might say, petty bourgeois elements. But we picked up enough workers and so forth and colonized enough workers that the class content of the Trotskyist movement started to change over to proletarianization. We had our convention in January 1st, 1938, and the Socialist Workers' Party was founded. Had that convention in Chicago. We took the count and we find out we had 1,600 members. We went in the Socialist Party, by the wildest stretch of the imagination, we probably had 300 members when we went in the Socialist Party. And we came up with that with 1,600. Now, that didn't mean that these 1,600 members that came out of the Socialist Party were 100% Trotskyist, by no means. And under the pressure of reaction that started to gallop at this time, many of these elements recognized the fact that they made a bad mistake by joining the Trotskyists, and that they quit between 1938 and the time that the Shachtman business broke out in 39. But the interesting thing is this, drawing the balance sheet. Now, Hugo Waller was going to be pure and holy. He wasn't going to hit his hands dirty fooling around with these renegade socialists. When we take the balance sheet, we find out that Hugo Waller didn't enlist one single socialist in his organization. He remained pure and holy, and nobody listened to him. And he remained himself as a good sectarian, and instead of gaining members, the organization split down the middle, and he and Stan went at each other's throats. Stan was the co-leader of the organization. The program that we adopted in Chicago was the program that we have today, the program of World Trotskyism. Did we accomplish our task of taking the militants out of the Socialist Party? We took 100%. The Socialist Party, after 1938, remained nothing but a skeleton organization. That's what it is today. They've never run another election campaign on a national scale after 1938. In other words, we took the young blood out of it that they used to build their organization, that did their legwork for them. Now we can draw another balance sheet to the work and the experiences that we had in the Socialist Party. See, there's no use going through experiences unless you learn. If you can't learn from experiences, then you'll never make a real Leninist, by no means. One thing we learned from all of what? Never split from the mainstream. All right? Ola was a very capable man, no question about it. Highly respected by Jim Cannon as a real trade union organizer. And he went into the political field, made a fool of himself, split from the main current, and ended up in the dung heap of revolutionary politics. You don't split from the main current, which is the World Trotskyist Movement. That's what I'm talking of in this sense. World Trotskyist Movement represent the cream of the crop. And if you can't convince them the correctness of your program, how are you going to correct the hillbillies? The typical American worker that thinks that the Democratic Party or the Republican Party is the real party of the working people. If you can't convince your own comrades, then you're a sectarian and you're out in left field. The Marxist Party, educated in class struggle principles, or the fundamentals of Marxism, can correct itself if it makes a mistake, the same as the Russian Bolsheviks did in April 1917. Why was it, remember we had the class on the history of the Russian Revolution? Why was it that Lenin could come back? And the only leader in the whole party, the only national leader in the whole party, take off his coat, lay down an ultimatum to all the leaders that have been in Russia already, that control the press of the party. Why is it that he could take off his coat on April 7th and on April 22 have the whole program of theirs reversed, completely reversed? Instead of collaboration with the bourgeois government that Kamenev and Stalin wanted, and most all the great leaders of Bolshevism, the ones that were trained directly by Lenin, you might say, they wanted to collaborate with the capitalist class. And how could Lenin come back and in 14, 15 days reverse this whole thing and stand it on its feet? He did it because he educated the rank and file in working class politics. That's why. That's why he could do it. And don't forget that the Bolshevik workers of Vyborg, the suburb of Petersburg, where the working class lived, the workers of Vyborg had already revolted against the line of Pravda, which was edited by Stalin and by Kamenev, and which advocated collaboration underneath the board, of course, with openly with the bourgeois government insofar as it stood for the revolution. The famous phrase of every opportunist. And that's a very important thing to remember too, if you're in doubt in a factional situation. Like we were in 1936. Cannon wants to sneak us into the Socialist Party, huh? He's gonna sneak me in, that's what I said too. I said that in 1936. They went with Musty to call you Kramitz a couple of weeks ago. Now what was the correct thing? Go with Ola and into oblivion, or go with Cannon? Well, we had been educated in working class politics, couldn't we have corrected the situation? Of course we could have, if Cannon was going to sneak us in and so forth and so on. See, under democratic centralism, the individual member in the party can retain his or her principles by not making a fool or a pest of himself or herself. How many times have you, in a factional situation, you'll see like Walford and Robinson, they made a fool of themselves. They made a pest of themselves. One of the comrades counted all the internal bulletins that they put out one time, the party put out for these people. I think it was 14 bulletins, wasn't it? Pete Comeo counted them. In other words, an experienced party person reads the first bulletin, sees what they're yakking about. Then, Jesus Christ, he hardly gets through that, out comes another one. Well, he's busy doing party work, trying to build a party. Looks at him, yeah. Before he gets through looking at that, there's another one. Well, by that time he says, for Christ's sake, these people are screwy. And that's all. He made a pest of himself. You don't make a pest of yourself, you issue your position, you fight for it, and everything will come out in the wash. If you're correct, it'll be proven. Don't worry about it. That's one of the things of life. That's the great thing about politics, as Cannon says, in politics versus religion. Jim says that in religion, you can't prove anything. You can't prove how many angels are dancing on the end of a pin. But in politics, life proves whether you're correct or not. And that's why I say, under democratic centralism, we can always prove whether we were right or wrong once we state our position. Now, another important thing in regard to factionalism. I have to read this, and it's not meant for towards any comrades in the movement here. Don't let us kid ourselves. This is very important, comrades. See, they say we live and learn. You don't live, you don't learn, for Christ's sake. There's no use fooling around here. We're serious people, and we're not going to fool around with revolution. On page 230, Jim Cannon writes in regard to the actions of Musty protecting his pals down in Allentown against the charge that they're collaborating and working underneath the board with the Stalinists. And being urged on by this Ahern, Musty continually gets between the party and his Stalinist friends. Jim says, we try to educate not only the comrades involved in Allentown, but the whole party on what conciliation with Stalinism means in a revolutionary sense. But this work was hampered by the fact that these people were personal friends of Musty, and that Musty protected them. For factional reasons, he protected his friends against those who, he admitted, were defending a correct political line. Instead of taking a clear stand with us, and joining with us to put pressure on the Allentown people, he would step in between us and them, blur the issue, and prevent any kind of disciplinary action against the most flagrant violations. Blinded by the intensity of the factional struggle, Musty put the thing on a factional basis, protecting his friends. That is one of the gravest offenses against the Revolutionary Party. What has to be protected in the party, first of all, are the principles of Bolshevism. If one has friends, the best thing he can do for them is to teach them the principles of Bolshevism, not to protect them in their error. If you do that, not only do your friends go to the devil, but you go with them. The friendship business is all right for Tammany Hall, which is based on the exchange of personal favors. But friendship, which is a very good thing in personal life, must always be subordinated to principles and the interests of the movement. I said to Musty after one of these exhibitions, you are going to be terribly shocked some morning when you wake up and discover a Stalinist nucleus in the Allentown trying to betray the party. And that's exactly what happened. I'm going to give a little instance of this friendship crap. When Shachman and his tribe quit the movement in 1940, they maneuvered, you know, they wanted a paper of their own and all this stuff. Shachman, of course, knew better. But power rationalization is endless, and factionalism is one thing that can make it endless. They couldn't put out their paper, but they control the youth organization, and they use this to peddle their yelling for the blood of the Soviet Union. And I'll never forget it. That night, the first night they put out this goddamn rag, in April 1940, my brother comes in the headquarters peddling it, because this was a challenge to our party. Well, what do you do in this case? Do you say, well, he's my brother? Of course not. Just wrote out the charges right then and there. Asked him, do you want to hear them or don't you? Doesn't make any difference, you're going to be expelled. Well, we just threw them out like that. Then he passed the paper to someone else and they said, no, I want to buy a paper. I remember Judge Levine was the organizer. Hey, Judge, write up charges on him too. Right now, right after the other. Just kick them out, snap of the finger. That's a revolutionary action. Well, that's it, comrades.